The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. And that is gsuggsinsurance.com. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 12, 2023. As usual, the outside border is red with a narrow white inner border. Time itself is in white, large block lettering, superimposed upon a background of red, white, blue, and gray. The red, white, blue is the flag of the United States of America. There's a gray panel in the center over which Time is superimposed. And on my right is another flag, the Great Seal of the State of Florida. It looks like a red and white background with the seal on top of it. In front of both is a photographic image of Ron DeSantis, what Ron DeSantis means for America. A young-looking man looking directly at the camera. He has, I'm going to say, gray-green eyes, brown hair combed slickly back from his forehead, wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, and silver-gray tie to match that panel behind him. He's holding in his hands and peeling an orange. Beginning with the brief, is Social Media Safe? By Alice Park. The U.S. Surgeon General is calling social media use an urgent crisis for kids' mental health. Even a viral pandemic was not enough to unseat what U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy sees as the defining public health crisis of our time. That designation, he says, belongs to concerns about the mental health and well-being of Americans, especially among young people. May 23, Murthy published an advisory warning that we do not know enough about how social media, in particular, is impacting children's emotional states, brain development, and social growth. I used this advisory because this is an urgent crisis, Murthy tells Time. After analyzing existing studies on social media's effects and consulting with experts, Murthy says there are not enough data yet to determine whether social media use is safe for children and adolescents. But with 95% of teens ages 13 to 17 and 40% of children ages 8 to 12 saying that they use a social media platform like Instagram or TikTok, Murthy issued a call to action to better understand what social media is doing to the mental health of America's young people. Murthy acknowledges children gain some benefits from using social media. The platforms can make it easier to connect with others who share similar interests or experiences, which can help young people understand and process difficult events like loss and change. They can also expose them to new opportunities to learn about different places and ideas. But the negative effects of social media are becoming increasingly apparent, raising questions about how safe the overall experience is and whether the net effects are more bad than good. Studies have found that using social media can contribute to anxiety, depression, lower self-esteem among children and teens, and expose them to harassment and abuse, Murthy's report says. Brain imaging research also suggests excessive social media use could change the brain in ways that mimic addiction. The advisory also outlines how parents, policymakers, researchers, and technology companies can and should come together to make social media safer for children. I 100% see this as a responsibility for policymakers and technology companies, he says. Any company that produces a product consumed by kids has a fundamental responsibility to ensure it is safe. The U.S. government's role, he says, should be to establish safety standards for content and usage for technology companies to follow. But such standards have not been required for the two decades during which social media platforms have become popular. The burden for ensuring sites are safe and appropriate for children, therefore, largely falls on parents. We do not ask parents to inspect the brakes on cars children will ride in, or the ingredients and medications children use, or ask them to conduct chemical analyses of the paint used in toys made for children to make sure they're safe, says Murthy. We set standards and make sure manufacturers meet them. That is what's missing here. The first step toward creating those standards, he says, is to conduct more studies to better understand how children and teens are using social media and how their experiences can be made less harmful to their mental health. A critical part of that effort rests with the technology companies, many of which have been reluctant or unwilling to share relevant data from their platforms. I hear from researchers all the time they are not able to get full access to the data they need to fully understand the impact these platforms are having on children, says Murthy. As a parent myself, I do not want to feel there's information hidden from me about the impact products my kids are using may have on their mental health and well-being. This kind of data could also identify practices that technology companies use to promote continued and excessive use of their platforms, such as likes, comments, and auto-scrolling. Studies show prolonged engagement on social media often comes at the expense of other activities critical for children's health, like sleep and socialization. But even without more data, Murthy says policymakers and companies can start making immediate changes to ensure children are not harmed by social media. These include creating and enforcing age minimums for accounts and doing a better job of identifying potentially harmful content related to cyberbullying, harassment, and abuse, and keeping it off children's feeds. I acknowledge companies are trying to take steps to make platforms safer, but it is really not sufficient, says Murthy. Time matters. Children only have one childhood, and every day, every month, every year matters in the life and development of a child. The bottom line is that we have not made enough progress, Murthy says. As a consequence, I worry about the mental health and well-being of our children. Here's the bulletin, What Erdogan's Victory Means for Turkey and the World. This is by Yasmin Serhan. The Recep Tayyip Erdogan era lives on. After the longtime Turkish leader won the May 28 presidential runoff against opposition challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, that Erdogan survived the biggest test to his leadership in 20 years is remarkable, given the state of Turkey's economy and lingering public anger over the government's response to earthquakes in February that left at least 50,000 people dead. But he has retained his grip on a nation that can serve either as a bridge or an impediment. Close to home for Turkey's 85 million people, Erdogan's win means a continuation of today, says Galip Dalay, an associate fellow at the London-based Chatham House think tank. Since first winning as a pious heartland populist in 2003, Erdogan has consolidated power through constitutional changes, eroded the country's democratic institutions, jailed opponents and critics, many of them journalists. With five more years at the helm, it is unlikely Erdogan will choose to reverse Turkey's democratic backsliding, even as the republic marks its 100th year. When autocrats face an unstable domestic context, they double down on repression, says Gonel Tol, a Turkey expert at the Middle East Institute. NATO's future, while the alliance's other members have condemned and imposed sanctions on Russia in the aftermath of its invasion of Ukraine, Turkey has continued to steer its own course with the country. In 2017, Ankara agreed to purchase an S-400 missile defense system from Moscow. Most controversially, Ankara continues to block Sweden from becoming NATO's 32nd member. Though analysts expect Erdogan to eventually lift Turkey's veto, as he did with Finland, it will be only after leveraging public concessions. A boost for autocrats. Under Erdogan, Turkey has joined the ranks of the world's most prominent electoral autocracies. But whereas some of them have been at loggerheads with the West, Turkey maintains a delicate balancing act. Whether that continues will largely depend on the U.S. and especially the EU. Is the West ready to confront a more authoritarian Turkey, asked Toll, noting Turkey hosts roughly 3.6 million Syrian refugees and has blocked them from crossing into Europe. Or are they going to keep this transactional relationship and say, as long as Erdogan keeps Syrian refugees in Turkey, we can work with him. We can tolerate him. There's a photo that's nearly half a page in color at night with the Turkish flags waving. Lots of people looking happy as if they're watching fireworks or something like that, and perhaps they are. Men, women, children, there's a child upon the shoulders of a man, all laughing or smiling or grinning or waving. The supporters of President Erdogan celebrate his re-election in Istanbul, May 28. From the brief news world, how everyday Iranians backed the revolt, by K. Armen Serjoy. Another photo of people celebrating in the streets, holding what appear to be bouquets of heather or some other such dried flower or plant. A few people visible here, only the backs of them, because mostly the area is jammed with vehicles going in all kinds of directions and probably going nowhere. Iranian protesters on the street in Tehran, October 1. Revolutions do not happen only in the streets, yet the outside world knows the uprising in Iran almost entirely through footage uploaded from camera phones, thousands upon thousands chanting for the fall of the regime in cities and towns across the country, the regime answering with batons and shotguns. There's been no window into the kitchens and courtyards where the country's fate will be decided. I did not think a country could change so much in 3 months, says journalist K. Armen Serjoy, reflecting on returning to Tehran last September after a summer in Germany. Serjoy, who's covered his native country for more than 2 decades, was not allowed to work as a reporter while he remained in Iran, but he remembered what he saw, and since returning to Europe, he has written it down. On an October night, at least 600 security forces are arrayed down a 2-mile stretch of Tehranpar Street, that's been a focus of protests for weeks. Armor-clad police special forces hold intersections. Revolutionary guards on motorcycles swing clubs at protesters who stand their ground. Middle-aged Basijis stand outside mosques and government buildings. The activists, meanwhile, are overwhelmingly young. Many of the women let their hair flow free. Apart from the two sides, a bigger group circulates, an almost unending sea of young families, elderly couples, passers-by, some just walking up and down the street, some sitting in their cars in the traffic. They're not protesting anything, yet they brave the tear gas, the shouts, to move along. They act as if it were just another evening, but they're also giving cover to protesters who disappear among them to escape the frenzied charges of security forces. This watchful sea, the silent majority known in Iran as the gray caste, fills space vacated by fleeing protesters, almost as if none were ever there. Whenever a plainclothes agent singles out a protester, cornering him or her till reinforcements arrive, the cars commence honking. Passers by suddenly become immobile, shouts of "Let them go!" rise to deafening levels, stunning the security forces, and many a time giving protesters just enough time to slip away. People on the sidewalks and in the cars, people with responsibilities, with families to support, people on whom the future of Iran will pivot, know how to bide their time, waiting for the protest to produce leadership, specific objectives, definite plans, at which point they just might step in and risk what little the Islamic Republic has left them. Every night at 9, the shouts begin from rooftops, balconies, windows of dark rooms. Women and men, sometimes even children, huddled into the dark recesses to avoid inquisitive eyes, shout, "Zan, Zendegi, Azadi," woman, life, freedom. It started days after Mahsa Amini died in police custody, arrested for how she wore her headscarf. Sometimes the chanting goes for an hour. In a middle-class Tehran neighborhood, a man asks a 19-year-old neighbor why he endangers his life every night by leading chants in the street and writing slogans on the walls. The young man replies, "Since we were born, we have seen how the regime has been gradually sucking the life out of our parents with inflation, price hikes, limitations on social and personal freedoms. If I have to go, I prefer to go fast." A few nights later, the young man goes out to spray paint slogans and does not come home. His frantic parents search prisons, police stations, hospitals, morgues. The neighbors moved, for now, only as far as the window where he joins the nightly shouting. "When the time comes," he says darkly, "I will avenge the kid." The regime is watched closely for evidence of weakness. The evidence is everywhere. Neighborhoods that historically supplied the militias that put down dissent have themselves become hotbeds of protest. But the regime is also ruthless. The death toll compiled by human rights groups, 506 by mid-December, does not take in the grievously wounded. Young women who've lost an eye to birdshot post their new looks proudly on Instagram, but their assailants speed away. On a cold December night, the security forces on Tehran Pars begin closing up shop at 8 p.m. The streets of major cities have seemingly been to some extent tamed. And yet, even as the number of protesters has fallen, the gray caste continues to show up to offer them cover. And stores that in previous years pulled down shutters at the first sign of trouble are still open. At one, a young man out of breath from fleeing police pauses to share his frustrations. "The problem is there's no direction, no planning," he says. "With the murder the regime is committing every night, the price is too high for what is becoming a blind revolt. And yet every night the windows still fly open and the chants begin." "It is not over," says another protester, a literature student in her early 20s. "The fire is still there. It is what in Farsi we call fire under the ashes." The brief news, good question, "Is everyone going back to the office yet?" by Alana Samuels. You might have thought that by mid-2023, with the pandemic officially over, people would be getting back to the office. But the share of workers in the office full-time dropped to 42% in the second quarter of 2023, down from 49% in the first quarter, according to the Flex report, which collects insights from more than 4,000 companies employing more than 100 million people globally. Meanwhile, the share of offices with hybrid work arrangements hit 30% in the quarter, up from 20% the previous quarter. "It certainly looks like hybrid's gaining share," says Robert Sato, CEO and co-founder of Scoop Technologies, which puts out the Flex report. Work is moving toward what Sato calls structured hybrid, in which there are a set number of days people are required to come into the office. The average minimum days required is 2.53, with both 2 days and 3 days being popular. Tuesday's the most popular day required, followed by Wednesday and Thursday. Few offices require a Friday presence, and only 24% require a Monday presence. Of course, not all companies are going to accept that they cannot get employees to return to offices, for which they have to keep paying rent. Tesla mandates full-time office attendance. J.P. Morgan Chase requires senior staff to be in the office full-time. Apple is reportedly tracking employee attendance and threatening action against staff who do not come in. Workers at Disney are required to go into the office 4 days a week, though thousands signed a petition protesting the policy. Opponents argue that return-to-office policies disadvantage people of color and women who are discriminated against in person and make life more challenging for working parents who do not want to waste hours commuting and cannot afford nearby homes in today's housing market. Workplace flexibility differs dramatically depending on the company's industry, size, and location. Nearly 2 in 3 companies that have fewer than 500 employees are fully flexible, meaning employees can be remote if they want, according to the Flex report. By contrast, only 13% of companies with more than 50,000 employees are fully flexible, though 66% do allow for structured hybrid work. States in the west and northeast parts of the U.S. have the highest share of companies that are fully flexible, with Oregon, Washington, and Colorado topping the list. Arkansas, Alabama, and Louisiana had the highest share of companies that are in the office full-time. There are other signs, in addition to the Flex report, that five-day-a-week return-to-office plans are not succeeding. Office occupancy in the top 10 most populous U.S. cities was just 49.9% of pre-pandemic levels the first week of May, according to data from Castle Systems, which tracks key card swipes across 2,600 buildings. One result of that trend is that consumer spending has plummeted in center cities in places like New York, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., while home values in exurbs and suburbs have continued to surge. The commercial real estate market has not completely tanked yet because many companies are signed into long-term leases. What is more, the format of structured hybrid work means employers cannot dramatically shrink their spaces yet. If every employee comes in the same 3 days a week, the company still needs the same amount of space it did before the pandemic. Companies just pay for empty office space on the remaining days. The share of days worked from home appears to have stabilized at 30%, about 5 times what it was before the pandemic, according to research by Nicholas Bloom, a Stanford professor who studies remote work. That could be a good thing for employees and employers. People who work from home are more productive and 1/3 less likely to quit than those who don't, Bloom finds. As technology advances, Bloom expects the share of people working from home to trend upward as technology advances. With better video calls, augmented reality, virtual reality, there may start to be less of a difference between working in an office and being at home, he says. The office world that appeared unchangeable before the pandemic is different now. That much, at least, is pretty clear. Milestones. This page features a, more than half a page, maybe 2/3 of a page, photograph of Tina Turner with Tina Turner being a name under Died. Tina Turner, indelible voice. Tina Turner's on stage here. She's standing right up close to the microphone. Under spotlights, brown skin, reddish-brown hair, coral-colored lips. The mouth is open because she's apparently singing. She's wearing a mesh-like goodness, I think it's a mini skirt deal or a mini dress. It looks like mesh, but it is not transparent. It's opaque underneath, so it's lined with something. It's metallic, maybe gold and silver, and then she's got kind of a gold-colored belt. Very snazzy. Tina Turner, Indelible Voice by Saussure Berga. When Tina Turner died May 24 at 83, many remembered her as Queen of Rock and Roll, but the chart-topping hit for which she will perhaps be most remembered is not a rock song. What's Love Got to Do with It?, which debuted in 1984, spent 28 weeks on the Billboard chart, including three at number one, and provided the title for a Turner biopic. It launched a new, triumphant phase of her career, which had faltered when she was dropped by her record label shortly after the end of her marriage to Ike Turner, following years of domestic abuse that she went public about in the 1980s. Did you know that when I first read the lyrics for What's Love Got to Do with It, I rejected the song? Turner wrote in a 2021 Instagram post. She'd been wary the single was more pop than her typical sound, but after the song was reworked to better fit her style, she agreed it worked. What's Love Got to Do with It went on to win three Grammys, including Record of the Year. Also under the died column, NFL player Jim Brown, May 18 at 87. His complicated legacy includes both civil rights activism and accusations of assault. Agreed. President Joe Biden and Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy to a debt ceiling deal, May 27. Congress had until the first week of June to pass the bill in time to avoid default. Impeached. Texas AG Ken Paxton, by a chamber controlled by his own party, May 27, facing accusations that include bribery and abuse of public trust, the Republican denies wrongdoing. Honored, Sherpa guides and climbers by Nepal's government, May 29, to mark the 70th anniversary of the first ascent of Mount Everest. Imprisoned, Elizabeth Holmes, disgraced Theranos founder, who reported to a Texas prison for her 11-year sentence, May 30, signed anti-gay legislation that includes the death penalty for aggravated homosexuality by Uganda's president, May 29. Emptied more than 2 million liters of water from a reservoir in India on the order of an official who had dropped his smartphone into it, May 21, while taking a selfie. He has been suspended. The phone, when retrieved, did not work. The View, Pride, by Judy Berman. Reality TV confronts a dark moment for LGBTQ rights. All things just keep getting better, proclaims the theme song of reality show Queer Eye, which celebrates its 20th anniversary in July. For years, that sentiment rang true for LGBTQ rights. Don't ask, don't tell was repealed in 2011. Federal marriage equality arrived in 2015. Trans figures like Laverne Cox and Elliot Page burst onto the national stage. But the 2020s have been painful for queer and trans Americans. Hearing a brass band belt out this optimistic refrain in the new New Orleans set, seventh season, you might ask, all things just keep doing what now? Such is the bittersweet experience of watching LGBTQ reality TV in 2023. It is heartening to see evidence of people with diverse sexual orientations and gender identities thriving, yet there is something surreal about Queer Eye doing cheerful makeovers in a state with a Don't Say Gay bill. and RuPaul sending queens down the runway amid a flurry of anti-drag legislation. After decades as small-screen vanguards of a movement that used pop culture as a soapbox, these shows are scrambling to meet the moment. Queer Eye and RuPaul's Drag Race deserve a lot of credit for bringing LGBTQ culture into the mainstream, but they were hardly the first in their genre to do so. The Real World made Pedro Zamora, a gay AIDS activist who died in 1994, a secular saint. A generation earlier, the PBS documentary and reality TV template, An American Family, took viewers into New York's queer demimonde with the family's son, Lance Loud. Both men made a profound impact as the first real out gay people many viewers got to know. While The Real World and An American Family dug into who their subjects were, Drag Race and Queer Eye spotlight what they do. The latter series' first iteration paired hapless heterosexual men with a quintet of gay stylists and lifestyle gurus for uplifting makeovers. Despite capturing the early 2000 zeitgeist, the show was rightly criticized for framing its Fab Five as little more than useful helpers. Netflix's 2018 revival avoids that trap. Thanks to a new cast we get to know better and a broad range of makeover subjects, some of whom are LGBTQ. Despite its jubilant tone, there are nods to our current political moment, from the Deep South setting to the rainbow-hued frocks worn by grooming expert Jonathan Van Ness. One emotional episode spotlights Stephanie, a lesbian who styles herself as the ultimate New Orleans sports fan to appear more palatable in the wake of a traumatizing experience of homophobia. It is an acknowledgement that as empowered as the Fab Five may be, many still experience daily prejudice. To understand the impact of Drag Race, take a look around the reality TV landscape. In the 14 years since it debuted, it has spawned not only 11 international editions and several stateside spin-offs, but also a universe of drag-themed entertainment, from HBO's road trip series We're Here to the Discovery Plus renovation romp Trixie Motel. This Pride Month brings Season 2 of singing competition Queen of the Universe and Hulu's Dinner Party Face-Off, Drag Me to Dinner. Current events have in turn influenced Drag Race. The franchise partnered with the ACLU to create a drag defense fund. Season 15 crowned Sasha Colby the show's second consecutive trans winner. And the eighth All-Star season, currently airing on Paramount Plus, welcomed back Monica Beverly Hills, who made TV history in 2013 when she came out as trans. The revelation sparked important conversations about the relationship between drag and gender identity, which might have continued in All-Stars had she not been cut in the premiere. Maybe it is surprising that as some of the most iconic queer voices in TV deliver advocacy and delight, the LGBTQ reality series that feels most urgent is the ultimatum Queer Love. This edition of the Netflix series gives a pride-friendly twist to season one, in which straight couples who could not agree on whether to get engaged had trial marriages with other cast members to clarify their futures and incite drama. This time, all participants are female or non-binary. Rather than a platform for minting celebrities, the show's a window into its non-famous subjects' everyday lives. Couples considering marriage are weighing universal questions, and the Queer Love cast is no exception. Though most seem genuine, not all are likable. Yet aspects of their situations are relatable to anyone who's ever been in a long-term relationship. it probably is not a good sign that the most resonant LGBTQ reality show not only echoes the pre-marriage equality slogan, love is love, but also, like the real world and an American family, serves in part to underline the humanity of queer people. No one should need such a reminder, and I doubt many right-wing voters will be watching. But just as there is value in the performative empowerment of Drag Race and Queer Eye, there is value in zooming in on the quotidian realities of queer love at the time of marriage equality. If Hollywood in general seems frustratingly impotent in the face of repressive legislation, at least these shows are a balm for those struggling to survive it. Judy Berman wrote that view. From theater, this is by Laura Zornosa. Tony nominees J. Harrison Gee, that's G-H-E-E, and Alex Newell make history. You're the first this is question and answer. Okay. A question. You're the first non-binary acting nominees in Tony history. The Tonys currently separate categories by gender. What would change look like for you? Newell answers, the change itself is extremely hard to make. If we talk about why the categories were separated at the beginning, it was to give other people than cis white men awards. We did take gender off some awards in the UK, and the only thing that won was cis white men. It's a deeper conversation. I think it's adding a category, widening the horizon of the category. Question, you both grew up in the church. How did that shape you? Gee answers, you know how to make the church go up in a way of, I'm using what I got today. It is such a formative way of learning yourself as an artist. Newell answers, and your instrument in general. You create your own style in church. The fact that gospel and hymns have their own diaspora inside a genre. Question. You also have significant drag experience. Did drag change your perceptions of yourselves? Gee answers, I was young Lola from the musical Kinky Boots, playing in my mom's clothes as a kid, so it was me tapping into the little version of me and that freest, most imaginative person. Newell answers, I never knew what drag was because I did not know what I was doing when I was putting on my mama's heels and tromping around the house. Honey, I cried the day my foot went past a 7. Question. Jay, I read that you helped shape your character Daphne in Some Like It Hot. Gee answers, when people ask me my pronouns, I say all things with respect. I understand the world is conditioned to respond to what they see, so they're always going to immediately say he, him. But I do not expect you to know what I am carrying that day. I walk in the fullness of who I am at all times. Question, what happens if you win? Newell, in my spirit, I've already won. I created a lane for somebody after me to come and do exceptional. I've created space and conversation and made the ruckus. If I win, yay, I will put the statue in my bathroom, and I will play with it every time I brush my teeth. Gee answers, I was not a theater kid growing up. I grew up singing in church, and so it was like, well, I sing and dance, and people respond, theater sounds right. And then to find Billy Porter's album of At the Corner of Broadway and Soul, I was like, whoa, there is somebody in this industry I can look up to. So to now be that for somebody else, again, the winning is already happening. Technology, survival of the fittest, the evolutionary case that humanity is already on its way to giving up its own dominance, by Dan Hendricks. That's spelled H-E-N-D-R-Y-C-K-S. Hendricks is director of the Center for AI Safety, a San Francisco-based research nonprofit. It shows those five levels of evolution here, from the ape to the Homo sapien. And then there's a giant microscope, mighty high-tech microscope. A broad coalition of AI experts recently released a brief public statement warning of the risk of extinction from AI. There are many different ways in which AIs might become serious dangers to humanity, and the exact nature of the risks is still debated. But imagine a CEO who acquires an AI assistant. They begin by giving it simple, low-level assignments like drafting emails and suggesting purchases. As the AI improves over time, it progressively becomes much better at these things than their employees. So, the AI gets promoted. Rather than drafting emails, it now has full control of the inbox. Rather than suggesting purchases, it is eventually allowed to access bank accounts and buy things automatically. At first, the CEO carefully monitors the work, but as months go by without error, the AI receives less oversight and more autonomy in the name of efficiency. It occurs to the CEO that since the AI is so good at these tasks, it should take on a wider range of more open-ended goals, design the next model in a product line, plan a new marketing campaign, or exploit security flaws in a competitor's computer systems. The CEO observes how businesses with more restricted use of AIs are falling behind and is further incentivized to hand over more power to the AI with less oversight. Companies that resist these trends do not stand a chance. Eventually, even the CEO's role is largely nominal. The economy is run by autonomous AI corporations, and humanity realizes too late that we've lost control. These same competitive dynamics will apply not just to companies but also to nations. As the autonomy of AIs increases, so will their control over the key decisions that influence society. If this happens, our future will be highly dependent on the nature of these AI agents. The good news is that we have a say in shaping what they will be like. The bad news is that Darwin's laws do too. Though we think of natural selection as a biological phenomenon, its principles guide much more, from economies to technologies. The evolutionary biologist Richard Lewontin proposed natural selection will take hold in any environment where three conditions are present. 1. There are differences between individuals. 2. Characteristics are passed on to future generations. 3. The fittest variants propagate more successfully. Consider the content recommendation algorithms used by social media platforms and streaming services. When particularly addictive algorithms hook users, they result in higher engagement and screen time. These more effective algorithms are consequently selected and further fine-tuned, while algorithms that fail to capture attention are discontinued. This fosters the survival of the most addictive dynamic. Platforms that refuse to use addictive methods are simply outcompeted by platforms that do, leading to a race to the bottom among competitors that has already caused massive harm to society. In the biological realm, evolution is a slow process. For humans, it takes 9 months to create the next generation and around 20 years of schooling and parenting to produce fully functional adults. But scientists have observed meaningful evolutionary changes in species with rapid reproduction rates, like fruit flies, in fewer than 10 generations. Unconstrained by biology, AIs could adapt and therefore evolve even faster than fruit flies do. There are three reasons this should worry us. The first is that selection effects make IAs difficult to control. Whereas AI researchers once spoke of designing AIs, they now speak of steering them. Even our ability to steer is slipping out of our grasp as we let AIs teach themselves and increasingly act in ways that even their creators do not fully understand. In advanced artificial neural networks, we understand the inputs that go into the system, but the output emerges from a black box, with a decision-making process largely indecipherable to humans. Second, evolution tends to produce selfish behavior. A moral competition among AIs may select for undesirable traits. AIs that successfully gain influence and provide economic value will predominate, replacing AIs that act in a more narrow and constrained manner. Even if this comes at the cost of lowering guardrails and safety measures. As an example, most businesses follow laws, but in situations where stealing trade secrets or deceiving regulators is highly lucrative and difficult to detect, a business that engages in such selfish behavior will most likely outperform its most principled competitors. Selfishness does not require malice or even sentience. When an AI automates a task and leaves a human jobless, this is selfish behavior without any intent. If competitive pressures continue to drive AI development, we should not be surprised if they act selfishly too. The third reason is that evolutionary pressure will likely ingrain AIs with behaviors that promote self-preservation. Skeptics of AI risks often ask, couldn't we just turn the AI off? There are a variety of practical challenges here. The AI could be under control of a different nation or a bad actor, or AIs could be integrated into vital infrastructure like power grids or the internet. When embedded into these critical systems, the cost of disabling them may prove too high for us to accept, since we would become dependent on them. AIs could become embedded in our world in ways we cannot easily reverse, but natural selection poses a more fundamental barrier. We will select against AIs that are easy to turn off, and we will come to depend on AIs we are less likely to turn off. These strong economic and strategic pressures to adopt the systems that are most effective mean humans are incentivized to cede more and more power to AI systems that cannot be reliably controlled, putting us on a pathway toward being supplanted as the Earth's dominant species. There are no easy, surefire solutions to our predicament. A possible starting point would be to address the remarkable lack of regulation of the AI industry, which currently operates with little oversight, much of the research taking place in the dark. Regulation needs to be done proactively rather than reactively. If something goes wrong in this domain, we may not get the chance to fix it. The problem, however, is that competition within and between nations pushes against any common sense safety measures. AI is big business. In 2015, total corporate investment in AI was $12.7 billion. By 2021, the figure had grown to $93.5 billion. As the race toward powerful AI systems quickens, corporations and governments are increasingly incentivized to reach the finish line first. We need research on AI safety to progress as quickly as research on improving AI capabilities. There are not many market incentives for this, so governments should offer robust funding as soon as possible. The future of humanity is closely intertwined with the progression of AI. It is therefore a disturbing realization that natural selection may have more sway over it than we do. But as of now, we are still in command. It is time to take this threat seriously. Once we hand over control, we will not get it back. Don't Call It an Arms Race. This is by Katya Grace. This may be abridged. for time purposes. The window, rushing forward on AI, could be the losing move for all of humanity. The window of what AI can't do seems to be contracting week by week. Machines can now write elegant prose and useful code, ace exams, conjure exquisite art, predict how proteins will fold. Experts are scared. Last summer, I surveyed more than 550 AI researchers. Nearly half of them thought high-level machine intelligence, if built, would lead to impacts that had at least a 10% chance of being extremely bad, that is, human extinction. May 30, hundreds of AI scientists, along with the CEOs of top AI labs like OpenAI, DeepMind, Anthropic, signed a statement urging caution on AI. Mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority, alongside other societal scale risks such as pandemics and nuclear war. Why think that? The simplest argument is that progress in AI could lead to the creation of superhumanly smart artificial beings with goals that conflict with humanity's interests and the ability to pursue them autonomously. Think of a species that is to Homo sapiens what Homo sapiens is to chimps. Yet while many fear that AI could mean the end of humanity, some worry that if we, usually used to mean researchers in the West, or even researchers in a particular lab or company, do not sprint forward, someone less responsible will. If a safer lab pauses, our future might be in the hands of a more reckless lab. For example, one in China that does not try to avoid substantial risks. This argument analogizes the AI situation to a classic arms race. Let's say I want to beat you in a war. We both spend money to build more weapons, but without anyone gaining a relative advantage, in the end we spent a lot of money and gotten nowhere. It might seem crazy, but if one of us does not race, we lose. We're trapped. But the AI situation is different in crucial ways. Notably, in the classic arms race, a party could always theoretically get ahead and win. But with AI, the winner may be advanced AI itself. This can make rushing the losing move. Other game-changing factors in AI include how much safety is bought by going slower, how much one party's safety investments reduce the risk for everyone, whether coming second means a small loss or a major disaster, how much the danger rises if additional parties pick up their speed, and how others respond. The real game's more complex than simple models can suggest, in particular if individual, uncoordinated incentives lead to the sort of perverse situation described by an arms race, the winning move, where possible, is to leave the game. And in the real world, we can coordinate our way out of such traps. We can talk to each other. We can make commitments and observe their adherence. We can lobby governments to regulate and make agreements. With AI, the payoffs for a given player can be different from the payoffs for society as a whole. For most of us, it may not matter much if Meta beats Microsoft, but researchers and investors chasing fame and fortune might care much more. Talking about AI as an arms race strengthens the narrative they need to pursue their interests. The rest of us should be wary of letting them be the ones to decide. A better analogy for AI than an arms race might be a crowd standing on thin ice, with abundant riches on the far shore. They could all reach them if they step carefully. But one person thinks, if I sprint, then the ice may break and we would all fall in. But I bet I can sprint more carefully than Bob, and he might go for it. On AI, we could be in the exact opposite of a race. The best individual action could be to move slowly and cautiously, and collectively, we should not let people throw the world away in a perverse race to destruction, especially when routes to coordinating our escape have scarcely been explored. Katya Grace, the author, is the lead researcher at AI Impacts, an AI safety project at the nonprofit Machine Intelligence Research Institute. Here is a one-minute synopsis of The Brief Health, Five Ways to Get Better at Small Talk by Angela Haupt. 1. Take advantage of free information. 2. Complement unique personal expression. 3. Skip marriage, kids, and work queries. 4. Respond generously. 5. Exit the chat gracefully. People often drag conversations on for too long because they cannot figure out how to end them, says Allison Woodbrooks, a professor at Harvard Business School who teaches conversation skills. Consider introducing the person to someone else, suggests Diane Wendingland, an author of books on communication skills. Make a positive comment about why they should meet and say, I'll let you two get to know each other. If that's not possible, briefly recap the conversation. I enjoyed hearing about your fishing adventures. And if you want, mention something you could do together in the future. Then, Wendingland recommends, concluding, like this, please excuse me, I have to talk to so-and-so. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.